Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings. Peace to the family. You are now listening to the House of the Morris King. I am your host, S.U. Miller L., a.k.a. D. Miller L. I have my co-host with me. Just a moment. All right, Brother Freak, you're there.
Yes, sir.
All right.
Got Brother Freak
on
the line.
Issues there.
Yeah, man. It was like saying unmute or something like that, but it's all good. We are here. We are rocking. You are on the House of the Morris King. What's good, brother?
Oh, wow. You know, I always feel excited, man. I feel like, you know, we're in the center of the eye of the storm. A lot of different things going on in the world right now. A lot of changes. You know, but here at the House of the Morris King, you know, we have a central theme. We deal with digitization. We deal with also decentralization. But at this particular show, I think that we're going to be able to expand the conversation. Those two concepts, digitization and decentralization, they're very broad in their scope. And I think on this particular show, we're going to start seeing, you know, how broad this can actually be. Let's go on ahead and... Let's actually open up the show unless you had something else you wanted to mention before we begin, Free.
No, go ahead. Open it up, bro.
All right. We have special guest, Wesley Days of EMC Arts. Again, family, be sure to spread the link. Let everyone that you know, make sure that you share this information with them. Let them know that they can actually find some very, very potent information right now with regards to conflict resolution. And I think that our community can stand to always have working strategies and, you know, have access to someone of that particular sort. Brother Wesley, are you there with us?
Yes.
How you doing, Brother Wesley? Yes, sir, we can hear you.
Great. How's everything out there?
It's hot, brother. How is it there?
It's beautiful. Mild. It's a beautiful evening.
Indeed. It's still daytime over here, and there's not a cloud in the sky. Free, how is the weather over there?
Yeah, it's the same. I mean, it's nice and hot, but it's windy, too, for us.
Okay, yeah, I got no wind over here. No wind. Okay. So Brother Wes, we're gonna kinda dive in a little bit, but first let's allow the listening audience to kinda become a little more familiar with you. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself, educational background and what it is that you do?
Yeah, I work in communities on different continents. I work often in Brazil and South America, worked in Central America, and also worked here in North America, which is my origins from the East Coast. Also had a chance to work in conflict resolution on the continent of Africa, particularly in Somalia and South Africa, and other parts of the Horn of Africa. And a little bit with some conflicts in the Middle East as well. So as a facilitator that works with conflicts, I'm usually in circles where the conflict is already very pronounced and doesn't have to be constructed in any way, and people need the ability to be able to find dialogue. And so my entire life has been devoted to finding ways to find that dialogue not only through words, but also non-verbally through movement, through music, and through ritualized theater as well. So I'm able to see conflicts and deal with and work with people and organizations on multiple levels. At the moment with EMC Arts, we're doing community innovation labs around the country and also abroad, and bringing these people together in these times now is very fulfilling work, because you get to see the common humanity in all of us. And recently, I've seen that the blockchain technology, the blockchain technology is also trying to build a consensus through digital identities, and find that a very fascinating link that we may be able to find and bring into aspects of facilitation and facilitating conflicts. And that's how we met at MIT.
Right. You know, I was actually going to ask, like, you know, with everything that you've described, and you really said it very eloquently just now, but with everything that you've described, it really doesn't sound like, you know, anything digital would necessarily be of value. I mean, not necessarily, it just doesn't seem that way immediately. So, you know, it becomes very curious to me, what exactly was it that you know, brought you to that conference? You said consensus. What exactly do you mean? What does that mean to your work in conflict resolution?
Well, I think that what really brought me to MIT was to be able to talk to people. I'd been doing research online and watching a lot of videos and watching a lot of, you know, talks happening in different settings. I even watched the MIT, the Bitcoin Expo from the previous year. And so I really wanted to see up close and meet people to hear how far along this thing really is and how much of it is hype and how much of it is real and just the compelling ways which some of the developers around Bitcoin talk about the philosophical underpinnings of it. I think that really is what attracted to me the most, because I saw that if some of these ideas really are being put into practice, then it's important for communities to know this. And I think that's one of the major themes that we connected around education and sort of getting the word out there, because so often technology comes in and doesn't get out to all the communities and all the people, or it takes time to do that. And so I wanted to know myself, since I'm a person that's in working in a lot of communities and traveling a lot. I mean, I'm on the road all the time. You know, I wanted to know and wanted to pass this information on. I wanted to cross-pollinate this information. And so finding you there, finding this program and, you know, your social media outlets that you're doing this outreach and this education around this technology, you know, I just think is really needed. But what attracted me to it is just that, this consensus building, being able to really create trustless communications and networks on the web, first based on cryptocurrency and the, you know, the ability to create you know, your own currency, but moving into smart contracts which can foster, you know, digital identifications, personas online that are trusted, that have reputations, that have, you know, of course have wallets as well, but can also be threaded discussion lists, decision-making tools for consensus, crowdfunding, and even voting systems. I don't know if you remember at the MIT, the guys, there were at least two people talking about how voting is also going to be blockchain technology adaptable. I think it was the government of Estonia, I think he said, was where they're using that. So for me, it was just very clear that this is going to keep growing, whether Bitcoin itself is the platform or the blockchain takes other manifestations, 2.0 or 3.0, is definitely here to stay, and I want to be able to utilize as a tool in my work in trying to strengthen communities.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Free, did you have any questions at this point?
I don't have any questions, but the brother's work has inspired me. I had a little epiphany last night after I was going over his work, and I was like, you know, what would be the ultimate like cyber hero thing to do? And conflict resolution came to my mind, and I said, you know, all these dark market things that happen in communities that the brother probably has to deal with online trafficking of drugs and weapons, and it causing conflicts within these communities, what would be the best thing to do is to buy out most of this stuff using Bitcoin so that we change the landscape of how these small communities do business so that the black market kind of gets pushed out of the way. So there's not even a need for it anymore. You know what I mean? And we save those children at the same time. So, like I said, the brother's work is definitely inspiring.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right. So, Wesley, you brought up, you know, how we linked up there at MIT. And as you said, it's definitely an experience. That was my first, Bitcoin expo or conference or whatever you want to call it, a meetup. That was my first as well. But I had been studying, the technology for about 3 years or so in advance. So, okay, I think there was something else that happened during our meeting as well that I think actually touched home with you with regards to this technology, this Bitcoin. So you don't live in the country, is that right?
Your family is not in the country. I'm based in Brazil.
Okay. So we were talking and it kind of just, became apparent when you were describing, your family and, what have you, that there's a need for you to be able to send money home. And I think that a lot of people can relate to this. Would you share with the audience, what went down there at the Bitcoin Expo with you and I and that situation?
Yeah, sure. So that's one of the powerful things about the blockchain. When you start to look at it, you know, if you have vision, then you can see various applications for it. So I saw a work application, which I've already mentioned, but I also saw in remittance payments, because it's not only Brazil, but I have people that I'm sending money to or receiving money from all over the world, and have always used the standard, banking techniques or even Western Union to be able to send those remittances. And when I started to see the amount of money that are, in the remittance payment industry, it's billions of dollars every year, and how the blockchain could cut those costs, I was really interested. And so I wanted to see whether I wanted a soft wallet or a hard wallet. I was looking at the Trezor, and I was looking at the Case and some of those other products that were out there to be able to use, Bitcoin to be able to make these remittance payments. And so finally, working with you, you got me into it now. So now I have a soft wallet. And I'm starting to replace some of my payments that I'm making, that I used to make through banking, traditional banking or Western Union or PayPal, with Bitcoin now. So I find it faster, easier, more reliable, and to a certain extent safer. I know there's a lot of people say that Bitcoin is kind of dangerous still, but I think that's getting better, and I think we see it getting stronger. And so it has affected my life personally in that sense, because I have a family all over the world.
That's powerful. And as you said, earlier on, like you said, there is a philosophy. There is, these concepts that, you kind of learn about as you're learning about Bitcoin. It's just very interesting, like you said. I don't know that there's ever been. Maybe there has been, and I think James is one of our previous guests. I think that this is what he was hinting at, but he was talking about the nature of voting.
Yes.
And the nature of voting is to come to a consensus.
Yes.
Some kind of consensus.
Yes.
Right? At least we can measure, the landscape, the terrain, and really, really determine where are the people on a given issue or whatever the case may be. So, wow, I find that powerful as well. There was a lot of things that attracted myself, you know, and Free, and actually many of the things that attracted you is exactly what attracted us.
Yeah, and so there's no doubt that the blockchain has, you know, its architectural component, which, you know, we saw the developers and the people who are the entrepreneurs building on that. But it also has that political part, and both the architectural and the political are, you know, related to this decentralization idea. And we have to always remember that. That's the revolutionary part about this, the decentralization fact. It's not always not all the businesses or the people that I saw at the expo or the people that we met. I think we're always keeping that in mind. Like, some people were building businesses off it, you know, to make money, to create, you know, sort of middlemen thing. But the idea around it really is decentralization, and that's what most attracts me in my work, working in communities, and also personally. So I'll give you an example. A lot of times we're able to raise money for communities who are doing prototyping about ideas that they want to do in communities. And so to support that, we're able to give, you know, we're able to give funding. And when we give that funding, we're trying to imagine what it would be like if we give the funding to several people and the community starts to make those decisions so that the funders get taken out of that central role. The funder usually plays the, you know, the centralizing role. What if we gave that role to the community so that communities can make decisions on their own about distribution and they can start to create their own cryptocurrency? I've seen that in places like in Brazil and Pernambuco. There are communities that have created their own sort of cash system, you know, the chip system. So you see the power that the community gets when they feel empowered doing it. This is how I see it very clearly, you know, connecting up, and has the ability to really be a powerful systems change.
That is very direct. I think that you said so much. I think the phrase or the terminology is, he who has the gold makes the rules, right?
Sir.
And what
so
you just
in,
described.
In the blockchain, you have self-executing computable contracts that will verify whether those own conditions are being met. And so the ability to secure, you know, those, that value, whatever it be, a contract or whether it be actually, you know, currency itself, it's very powerful and tamper-proof, you know, if you know how to set up the network properly. So the execution of the decentralization infrastructure is really why I'm looking at blockchain so seriously.
That's key. That's key. Free, what say you?
Oh, man. Like I said, that matches the vision I had, man. Like I said, just to take away the centralization about, like, how money is spent amongst a community of people, like, to not have give the voice to the each individual people who actually need the services and or, you know, infrastructure built in their community, not get a word in on how that money is going to be spent. You know what I mean? It's, like, contrary to the whole thing, but that's the way our world works now. And with decentralization and people being able to create their own coins to fund their own projects and everything like that and vote, I mean, there you go. We have a solution right there. And it's going to help this brother's work, you know, drastically, in my opinion, as long as personal finance as well, as he stated.
Yeah, that's exactly what I see, brother. And I think it's exciting. And I want to be able to continue to build with you all around this. Because for me, when I was in MIT, and what I see online is that not everybody has that vision. Not everybody sees the power, you know. I mean, I think the most powerful thing you hear people talking about in terms of communities is that the countries around the world that don't have strong banking systems will be giving, you know, banks to them just with a cell phone. And that's very powerful. But when you talk to people, that's the least developed part. Because most people, you can imagine, are going to be, you know, trying to get their grants for their research, you know, institutions or their centers, or wherever they are in North America or Europe, and so a lot of that focus is not going to be necessarily on the world. It might be in rhetoric, but I think that there are going to be some of us who are really going to try to hold it accountable, so that this technology is available for all and really does help to flatten things. That's where my focus is. And I think that that leads a little bit with the thing you were talking about with this whole political structure right now, with the election going on right now. Can you imagine, what if the same type of energy was put into building and creating structures, investing in community blockchains and smart contracts for our communities and for our peoples? Imagine if the same kind of intense energy, that courage to go and confront and be a protester, you know, and see some of the stuff that we see happening in the news. What if that energy was built, you know, was really put towards building a better system for us? And I think that that was something that we were talking about as we led up to this program today.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, wow, I have so many things rushing through my mind right now. So let me back us up to actually the beginning for just a second. Educational-wise, where did you go to school, brother?
I did my undergrad at Morehouse.
Indeed. And with that being said, is it in the sciences or is it in the arts, out of curiosity?
I came out of the history department. I focused on African history.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. This is the thing that I've noticed about our communities in particular. I've noticed that we don't necessarily pursue the sciences in mass, right? There isn't a large group there, but you actually tend to find, you know, many of our people studying like the social sciences. They make it into finance, but I'm not trying to broad stroke this, but I want to make a particular point in terms of the value. So I think it is our role, being on the other side as opposed to having gone to an MIT or a school for technology or science, it is our role to actually help with the adoption process. I'm sure that you noticed the type of people that were there at the Bitcoin Expo. And for the most part, I think that the big issue is how to explain this concept to the masses so that it is actually adoptable. Right now, it just sounds like a whole bunch of mumbo jumbo unless you're willing to, you know, spend the time and slow it down and read thoroughly, you know, the information.
No, I agree. So that's not narrow to us. I mean, I try to talk to colleagues as well about applying this, and it's difficult to wrap your head around sometimes.
It is, but I think that you've done a very good job. Just on this show with us right now, I think you have done a very good job in terms of explaining utility of the technology. I think that's key. Like, when we recognize the value of the thing, then maybe we're more apt to engage it.
Right.
So, okay, like you said, we were having a conversation, and I actually want to widen this a little bit.
Okay.
So we have a conflict right now. I'm sure that you're aware of Black Lives Matter.
Yes.
And the movement associated. I'm also sure that you're aware of some of the violence that has been going on during this election, during this run-up to the election.
Yes.
Okay, so would you classify that as a conflict? Because I definitely do. Right? Like, this is in the heat of the moment, right? This is not... It looks like there's going to be violence. It's starting to appear like, if I do look off into the future, I'm not sure if this is how you see it. I really would like your take as well. But it seems like there's a potential for maybe something like a race war. I'm not sure if that's how you see it. But it does seem very racially charged.
Right.
And there's just a lot of chaos going on, a lot of inflammatory rhetoric, et cetera, et cetera. So, brother, if you could give us, first and foremost, your diagnosis of the situation, and then kind of walk us through what you would do in these, you know, various locations that you've been dealing with certain kinds of conflicts. I'm not sure if you've ever dealt with one that's similar to this. If so, please share that with us as well.
Sure. Well, the first thing I would say is that I don't talk about this subject or what I do as an expert. I don't believe in that expertise. Expertise is when you have complicated problems, compli- complicated problem, you need an expert to solve it, you know. But I don't work in the complicated. I work in a realm that is the complex. And the difference between the complicated and the complex for me is that the complex deals with emergent thinking. That means you're going to need the sum total of the ideas and the sum total of the wisdom in the room or wherever you are to be able to fully deal with that problem, to be able to fully facilitate that problem. You're going to have to use emergent thinking. That means it's going to have to be produced in a process. It's not something that you can diagnose like a doctor and then, you know, go in and surgically take out. Sometimes you can in groups, you know, identify things rather quickly because you've had the experience and you've seen it before. But the most intractable conflicts are the most deeply rooted conflicts. It really is something that you have to get in the trenches and you have to start to dig, and you have to start to investigate, and you have to start to reveal. You have to start to drop barriers and boundaries that have been created, you know, over many, many years and many generations. And that's certainly what we're talking about here. That being said, this conflict has been around since the European came to this Turtle Island, this North America. So the conflict is almost inherent in the creation of the country. And then at the same time that it's in our nation, when I hear you talk about Black Lives Matter and the courageous efforts that they're making to call attention and to really game change in these relations that we're dealing with in this country, I think about Brazil as well, where the type of violence that people of African descent are facing, the type of police brutality they're facing, is exponentially larger, and people don't recognize the manifestation of that system today in Brazil. And so there's so much that we can learn just by broadening and not narrowing this just to our country or our hemisphere, but really take a global perspective on it. As Du Bois said, the race question is the question of the century, and it's still something that we have to be able to deal with. And I think that some of the analysis on Trump is that, you know, he's bringing this out, he's drawing it out. Some people want to give him the credit, you know, and say that he's a fascist and he by design doing it, and other people have other takes on it. But until we resolve, until we're able to deal with this question in a manner that we can have dialogue, that we can be able to see each other's common humanity, it's going to continue. And it reminded me, I was in a session in North America where I was talking a little bit about my experience, in West Asia and working with Palestinians and Israelis in conflict transformation. And in the middle of it, the guy said to me, "Yeah, but this is not, you know, this is America. This is not, this is not the Middle East." And you can't make those equivalents here. And I said, well, you know, they're actually more similar than you think. It's just that the power structure here has always been very effective at making sure that it doesn't go into a civil war like you have in other parts of the world. But that does not mean that the lines that are drawn are any different. And as you mentioned, we could be near a race war. We've heard that before. Are we? It's very difficult to bring it to a race war because there are very powerful structures in place to make sure that does not happen. We have to continue to study our past and continue to see the movements that came before Black Lives Matter and how they were effective in advancing the causes and the quality of life and the existence and our existence in this country to be able to map out solid political strategies. My contribution to that conversation, as I mentioned before, is let's try to devote some of our energies right now just towards solving practical economic problems that we can use using technology like this. I think it's
a battle that we have on all fronts, whether it be social, economical, political, diplomatic. But we cannot forget the economic a part of it, because it can provide stability for us to not be in some of the situations that we find our people in our communities today.
Understood. Free.
So what does that look like on? Yeah, what does that look like on the ground, right? That looks like you said, trying to get a wallet into a soft wallet into everyone's hands on the ground, so that they can make some type of financial decisions, because they might, like you said, might not be able to get a bank account, but they need to be able to store some type of money that they're making, doing whatever they're doing to, you know, keep themselves afloat. And I find in third world countries that they're on the net just as much as regular Americans, or you know, first world country people, for lack of a better term, right, are on the web just as much now. So their ability to start up websites and have startup companies, you know, they have the same abilities that we all have. So they should be able to take advantage of this as well, and bypass the central authority that's keeping them, you know, abused and oppressed, you know, because a lot of different governments, man, are really ruthless and will, you know, clear out your bank account and, you know, silence you and all that other stuff like that. You know, we have laws here that say, you know, they can't do that, even though, you know, they get away with it in certain instances and everything like that. But the overall theme is that we have to put power to the people. And this technology allows us to do that. You know what I mean? So on the ground, what do you think that would look like as far as your work goes, brother?
Well, before my work, I would just mention others. I just mentioned the post that I just put on the Facebook group about two 13 and 15-year-old Nigerian brothers who built mobile web browser alternative to Google Chrome. You know, another thing I posted or read about a project where black girls code, I think it's called, and they're learning coding skills to be able to deal with all sorts of apps. I think that it's about education. The facilitation spaces that I'm in, those are created by funders and organizations that are giving to try to further this dialogue. But these dialogues have been going on for years and years and years, and I think the facilitation might be limited. We're able to deal with, you know, with the pain that goes along with this, and we're able to create a space where people can try to come to better clarity, understanding. But I think it's going to take something like the blockchain to really restructure to, the power that we're dealing with here. And that could take us, you know, farther than we have than just trying to do it through, you know, dialogue process. There has to be some practical restructure. There has to be some social architecture going on here to be able to position ourselves in another way.
That's powerful. That's powerful. Wow. So okay, you know, I want to really nail this point home. I'm doing this for the sake of redundancy.
This is
one of those things that, you know, the blockchain has to offer as well. This is, you know, what makes it so robust. There's many, many, many ledgers, right? All the nodes on the network,
yeah.
All the miners on the network.
Yeah.
They're maintaining this ledger, and they've replicated the ledger. It's redundancy. So there is something to learn from, or at least in the concept of redundancy. So let me come at it from this angle. So okay, so if I understand what you're saying, yeah, we have a problem, but the way in which you attempt to go at it or even diagnose it is maybe an error, right? Maybe what you might want to do is focus on, I don't know, I don't want to necessarily say one side is negative, one side is positive. But it seems like, you know, what I presented was a problem. What you presented was a solution, maybe my problem, maybe to even other problems that I may have, right? Economic problems that I may have, et cetera. Is that what you're actually saying right now? Is that what's going on?
Well, I would want to avoid, you know, like you said, the good and the bad, the false binaries. I don't think that it's about that. I think that each of us has our own path. Each of us has been given powers by the Creator, and we should be practicing the highest levels of knowledge of self to know how to apply what we do, you know, in the environments and with the resources and skills that we have. I would never say somebody is making a mistake. You know, I just recognize at this point in my life, at a spiritual level, what contribution I need to make, and have been consistent with it for many, many years. Sometimes I've been working with youth groups in conflict transformation. Sometimes it's been with adults. Sometimes it's formal structures like the United Nations and Blue Helmet missions, or sometimes it's NGOs, non-governmental organizations. It's a variety of different ways that I've been placed in the position to be able to do this work. But I do believe that when I watch on the news someone with the courage to make a statement at at a rally that starts to border on fascism or is fascism, and you put your body in that line, I mean, I think that's very courageous, and I'm not going to ever call that an error. I just know that when I heard about the blockchain, I thought that this was an element of something that could help me contribute more to the work that I do. But I think that each person who's listening to me, hears my voice now, has to determine where and when they enter in this, once they identify this as something that needs to be transformed.
Excellent.
Yeah, that's like, and as far as the conflict goes, instead of a race war, I see more of an information war.
Yeah.
Like, from lack of information, man, like, that's what this really boils down to in the end. And the media's ability to manipulate footage and take quotes and expand them and make them go viral and choose to not make other stuff go viral, I think that whole algorithm system of the way they work with that has a major implication on how we view our world. You know what I mean? It's like they're playing with an algorithm on a server somewhere, and it's just, you know, we'll pull this guy's tweet out and put it out in front of the world, so everyone reacts to it and everything like that, and that becomes the meme or the vine for the week or whatever. But at the same time, that also can be used to destroy someone's life. So, I mean, you know, we have a serious conflict of drought of information and how people need to learn how to protect themselves. You know what I mean? This whole thing, like, with security, you know, like, it needs to be in your own hands. If you can't really outsource it, you know, everyone needs to know a certain amount of coding. If you're going to use a device and not know coding, someone, you're leaving a back door open for a hacker to come in, because you don't even know what to look for to protect yourself. You know what I mean? So it comes down to basic education about computers and how to use them so you can protect yourself and express yourself to the maximum potential.
Agreed. Well said.
Yeah.
All right. We're coming down to, I think, our last 10 minutes. Brother Wesley, you said you can do about 45 minutes with us.
Yeah, I'm a musician, so I got a gig, so I got to go for the sound check. I can go on for a little while longer.
Indeed. Well, I guess I can go in two different directions with this, and actually I think that we should, again, expand this conversation. Because I think there's application here as well. So you do music?
Yeah, I'm a musician.
Okay. Tell us about that. What kind of music you do? You know, tell us about that.
Well, I'm a multi-instrumentalist, and I write music. I have groups that I play with in Brazil, but also in North America. I play drums, I play bass, guitar, play some horns, and I've always sang. So
So music's always been a part of my life. And then I also incorporated music into my conflict transformation practice. So we use vibrational tones to really prepare groups to be able to have difficult discussions or difficult dialogues, or if we're doing a nonverbal dialogue for a whole other reason, you know, we're using the vibrations and the tones of music there. So so I'm always using music to be able to connect people together, whether that be a more traditional type of gig in a, you know, in a club-like setting, or whether that be in more of a larger world work type of setting with other facilitators. Facilitation comes in, you know, in different forms. You might now see it's popular. See graphic facilitation, where people are sort of drawing out speeches which people are making, so people can deal with dense topics. And then there's dance facilitation, like in the body. You know, the you know practices like capoeira, Angola. You know, it's a dialogue with the body. You know, so there's also elements that we use of body work in facilitation. And then there's a whole field of different types of theater techniques in facilitation, like playback theater, theater of the oppressed, Augusto Boal's work, a Brazilian playwright. So really the work that I'm doing is a very large scope, and music is just one of those strong pillars, I'd say, between music, movement, and ritual theater. Music is the one third of what I'm doing.
Indeed. Brother, I think that you posted something in the group, MBA Circle of Peers, for the listeners that would like to join the Facebook group and learn about, you know, this digitization, this decentralization that we've been talking about. I think you posted something in there, brother, about the effects that the blockchain may have on music and free. I definitely would like for you to speak on the decentralized mind mixtape. I think we're almost ready to produce the third volume of the series. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
Okay, that's good. So yeah, brother. Okay, indeed, brother West. I'm sorry, Free. You can definitely come in after me. Let me just say this, West. I want to give you the floor. Free, you can take up after him. But did you actually post something about, you know, the blockchain and its effect on, or its potential effect on the music industry, Wesley?
That was me.
Okay, so what do you understand about that? What I would like for you, because as I said, I think it's our role at this point to help that adoption by explaining, being able to, you know, explain this to someone in such a way that you're empathetic enough that they don't feel like you're trying to overwhelm them.
Correct. Well, the article was an interview with a guy named Benji Rogers, who was talking about a fair trade approach to music and virtual reality using the blockchain. And so for your listeners that, you know, already familiar with the blockchain, you know, these ideas of value being being able to be recorded, you know, on a public ledger. And so this article is about how he sees that the blockchain is perfect for music, because when you go into the studio, for example, you know, this is the era of the producer. You know, it's not like the big acts anymore. We have big acts, but, you know, producers play a very large role. So they invite people they want in for a certain sound. And a lot of the creative space that you find in the studio, people come in that surprise you, and they may drop something on the track, and then, you know, they're not principal on the track. They might not be called featured. But imagine, you know, you come in and you sing something on a track that I'm creating. Well, with the blockchain, we could be able to encode that you did that track or whatever contribution you made on that track, and then you would be able to divide royalties and publishing rights and all the other complicated things within the music industry more equitably. So the article is really trying to open people's up. You know, everybody knows, everybody hears the story about how shady the music industry was, and we see how, you know, like people are very wary. You know, you have to be savvy when you're entering into, if you want to make money on music. the blockchain is going to help make that process more honest, because once again, it's a trustless relationship at a distance, you know, decentralized. And so dealing with how musicians make money and producers and publishers and all those elements that create the sounds that we hear, along with all the other technologies that have already affected the music industry that we know about from the Napsters and everything else, that conversation is still going on forward. So, yeah, check that article out. I think I posted two articles about blockchain in the music industry. But it's definitely going to be able to strengthen, I think, people who have been wronged in the past. It's going to be virtually impossible for a big studio to take the lion's share of the fruits of the labors of artists and musicians. So I think it's a very positive thing that's coming down the road.
For you on deck.
I don't know if he had anything else, because I don't know how much longer we have with him on the line. I'll get into what I'm with the mixtape and everything after that. If you have any closing remarks,
Brother West, back to you. Any closing remarks? Any contact information you want us to be aware of? We will have this. You sent me some music. We'll have that available on the YouTube version of this show, so definitely subscribe to our YouTube channel, Moabit. That's MOABBIT. Just search that on YouTube, and you'll find all of these episodes.
Well, yeah, my closing. I saw on your in your members in the NBA Circle of Peers that you have 4,500 members. That's a lot of members. How many of those members are active, and how do you see the process of sharing this information, since I'm somebody who just came in recently?
Oh, wow. Free, you can go in first. I'll come in on the tail end.
All right. So we're doing a lot of different things. The Decentralized Minds mixtape, that is the project that we're currently, you know, using to bring hip-hop and music to the decentralized, you know, platform. So it's perfect that you posted that article, because we're experimenting with that. I published the first Decentralized Minds mixtape on the blockchain, and I had three artists on there who, you know, once the funds come in, they'll be receiving their royalties and everything accordingly. So I think the experiment is awesome, man. Like, and as a DJ, you know, I love playing people's music, like, especially people who have really good music, you know what I mean? And I like that, you know, atmosphere to be able to expose other people's music to crowds that may not have, you know, heard of a certain type of music before. So that, you know, I pride myself on that a lot too. So it's very exciting to hear that you're a musician as well. You know, I definitely want to, you know, come down to Brazil one day and we do a set, man. And my wife, you know, she sings and everything like that. So it's awesome, man. It's, you know, big things are about to, you know, really blossom from this whole music thing with the decentralization of it. You know, like you said, people won't be able to be frauded anymore. They'll receive their copywriting, their publishing, all of that can be verified on the blockchain. Smart contracts can make sure that the artist is treated fairly. And man, like I said, it's awesome. So yeah, that's just one arm of the NBA Circle of Peers that content that we're using to drive membership and to drive activity, you know, to get people engaged. And our other ways that we do is, you know, we bring up relevant topics to Bitcoin, of course, and to technology, business, economics, social, you know, issues, you know, social topics of all nature, you know, and try to tie them back into how decentralization can really help. And so I would say out of the 4,000 members, at least, you know, 400 of them are active a month. You know what I mean? So
that's great, man. Well, first, my hat's off to you. That's a beautiful effort of uniting folk around those ideas, and you're very welcome to come down to Brazil anytime you want, man. The community is waiting for you. And
indeed.
And the part of Brazil I'm in is Bahia, which is really the
Oh, I know some people in Bahia already. I've never been there myself, but I know some people there, so that's interesting. Maybe, SU, you remember them brothers back in the day when we were doing the sustainable housing? I can't remember their name. Sharif. Yeah, that brother. Yeah, exactly. So, you know, small world on the internet.
And that's what I think that to be focusing on now. Not only is a small world on the internet, but it's also a small physical world, and that we're actually getting more connected physically as well as virtually. So we need to make sure that we build on both sides of the equation. You know, make sure that we reinforce in the physical, so that the same issues that you're dealing with, we're dealing with in Brazil, and you know, and also on the continent. So we need to really start to strengthen those ties, because they weren't built that way in the beginning. And I think that's another thing that we really connected on when we were at MIT.
Absolutely. Yeah, the brother said it well. You know, we've used different kinds of strategies to you know, build our membership to what it is. I know one thing I'd like to include is that I normally will do every so often, I'll do a membership drive. And essentially, all that is required is that an individual add some of their friends from Facebook into the group. I'll put a certain number up there, a quota, and this is a task that probably takes, I don't know, anywhere between, depending on how much you want to get, because I'll rate it, you know, for the number of people that you add. However, you know, a lot of our membership has come through me being able to set that task, that drive, and then offer Bitcoin in exchange.
Oh, nice.
So a person would essentially, you know, bring in 25 people from their friends list that they think would be interested, right, in the information. And by doing that, I would then, you know, demonstrate, you know, the efficiency, the utility of Bitcoin. So, and not only that, you know, that's just obviously another way in which we can have people engage. I feel like when someone has the thing in their hand, it becomes more real.
Like you did to me.
That's right. That's right. That's right. So it comes out of the philosophical, right? Because I think that that's imperative. I think that our people are brilliant, you know? We are some of the most creative people in the world, but I think that, you know, and I'm speaking now to computer science specifically, I think that we need, you know, more avenues, and I think this particular avenue of computer science as a form of expression, that creativity, I think that we could build a better world. I think that we could build the things that we need, you know, to solve our problems collectively, locally, you know, globally, however you want to look at it, or however you want to deal with it. I think that we should absolutely embrace this concept. I don't know that, you know, that's been said enough in our communities.
Well, like you said in the redundancy, you said it again, so let's continue to build on it.
Yes, sir. I hope to have you back, Wesley. We're not going to keep you on the line. You know, again, we definitely are honored by your presence. We hope to have more interesting builds like this for the listening audience. Free, any closing words that you want to say to Wes before we let him go?
No, not really. Brother, peace, light, safe travels, everything you got to do, you know, stay strong, keep the faith, all of that.
All right, man. Good talking to you.
Yes, sir. Peace and love. All right, Free.
Yes, sir.
How you feeling about the bill?
What's up?
I said, how you feeling about the bill?
Pretty good, man. Pretty good. I like how people are getting to hear from different voices, man. Like the first year we did the Silk Road podcast, you guys heard from us specifically. Now you get to hear all the different versions of it from everyone else across the globe. You know what I mean? You've heard from Rabbi off in Israel. You've heard from Anari, who's formerly from Africa. You heard from someone from Brazil. So, I mean, let's keep it moving, man. This is it.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. You know what, man? I want to do something a little bit interesting right now. I want to talk about something that we didn't necessarily plan on talking about for just a second. And I think it'd be pretty interesting, just a little short dialogue. So, what's your take on this new release from Ethereum?
Well, my take is,
can you actually tell us what that is? I don't know if our listening audience is aware. But
I mean, our core audience is definitely aware. So, you know,
indeed.
But any new listeners right now, man, what Ethereum is a platform, a technology that was built on top of the blockchain technology that allows for smart contracts. These smart contracts are executed on this blockchain and are published to this blockchain. So with the ability to do that, we have the ability to start decentralized or autonomous organizations. And with the birth of that, you have different organizational structures that will supersede democracy and all of the centralization. We'll be able to vote. We'll be able to make decisions. We'll be able to send money free of centralized authority. So that's what Ethereum is essentially offering. Along with that, we also can create coins on the blockchain, on Ethereum's blockchain. Now, people will say, yeah, you can do all of this on blockchain. I mean, on Bitcoin. But the truth is that Bitcoin has its limits due in about, what, 2140, I think. Is that the expiration date on Bitcoin when it'll stop? What's up?
I don't forget the specific day, but you're talking about when there's no more coins to be mined.
Right. So a need for that to keep this going, you know, throughout history would be to create new coins that are based upon the same protocol, create new contracts and new blockchains that are based upon the same protocol. I mean, that's what Windows does when it updates its software and gives you the new operating system. It's only building on top of the base DOS from back in, you know, the 70s and the 80s, you know what I mean? So that's what we essentially have going right now. We're in that era in the era 7 BC, 7 blockchain. So as we evolve through this, we're going to have, you know, Ethereum's, and then we're going to have people build on top of Ethereum, which will make, you know, the strength of our governance even stronger, you know, as more people develop and more people become aware of developing and help develop these programs to meet the needs of their individual areas. We'll have, you know, a multitude of Ethereum's. Basically, each Ethereum will be like a country or a virtual nation, you know what I mean? So, you know, you tell everybody what you want to think about it, man. Like, how do you feel about Ether?
Yeah.
As a stack
all right, well,
Bitcoin.
Yeah. Well, actually, you know, it's all related, obviously, but wow. So let me do this with it. Let me say that Ethereum and the 21 Bitcoin computer are comparable. They are both platforms for building applications, decentralized applications, right? So now the difference, however, is very intriguing, actually. You know what I'm saying? It exists in the cloud. So I know we have that show on the Silk Road, you know, the cloud and game theory. We were talking about the value of DigitalOcean, right? This is the this is how we're at. This is the source in which, you know, we host, or we, you know what I'm saying, have a virtual server. We're essentially leasing space, right? There was no need for us to acquire servers to host a website. So the same can be said, the same difference can be made between the 21 Bitcoin computer and Ethereum. It's not that Ethereum doesn't require some kind of device. You obviously need a computer to be able to access. But the difference is the 21 Bitcoin computer is a physical thing. Right? And it's like having a physical server. And what we were talking about in terms of, you know, game theory. Hold on. We have to find a way to stop that. Okay, brothers. Do I
okay,
hear
brothers.
You?
Yeah. All right, it's clear.
All right. So, essentially, what we're talking about is a physical device as opposed to accessing a physical device virtually, right? What we call the cloud. And essentially, this is what Ethereum is. When you deal with Ethereum, again, it's similar to Bitcoin. You know, you're kind of using a command line to produce your applications. However, it looks something similar to DigitalOcean and how that platform is built, right, brother? Like you are a little more astute in these, you know, concepts. But you know, kind of break down what is DigitalOcean like, and then, like I said, comparisons become very obvious. It's very easy to deploy a website through DigitalOcean, you know.
Well, that's easy. Like you said, for the person who doesn't understand coding and everything like that, they can look up YouTube videos and look up tutorials. DigitalOcean is very tutorial friendly and helping you get your website started through them. So I think that information is given in a different way. It gives you a DIY experience. You know what I mean? Where you're able to do it yourself, like, as opposed to having, you know, a web designer go through and do it for you and everything like that. You know, that's you know, here or there, but the power behind being able to decentralize something like that, right? Even though the hardware exists somewhere in a central place, right? Even though they've kind of spread that out themselves, they have different servers in New York, in Australia, different parts of the world. So, you know, they've been able to decentralize that somewhat too. So there isn't a central point of failure on their hardware as well. So, I mean, using DigitalOcean frees you from, you know, having to, you know, deal with some of the old server companies that, you know, charge exorbitant fees for, you know, server. You're only charged for the amount you use as opposed to being overcharged for something you might not even be using. So I think that's one of the biggest things to help people, you know, get their website started as startup businesses are emerging and they're all becoming more online. Every business that's being started in the next, you know, 5 to 10 years is going to be an online business. They might have a brick and mortar to back that, but more than likely it's going to be an online business. So, you know, this DigitalOcean and Bitcoin and the blockchain are helping facilitate all of this, and watching it grow is exciting.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
And as you said, there's value in the idea of, you know, virtualization as opposed to having physical hardware. Now, what I'd also like to say is that with DigitalOcean, one of their selling points, and this is not an advertisement for them, they're not giving us anything for this, but one of the values or one of the selling points is that, you know, you can have a droplet deployed with a website within, like, what is it, like under 5 minutes, under 10 minutes, right? You're hosting, you're not only hosting the website and controlling it from that area, but then you can, you know, again, produce the website, you know what I'm saying, within a certain amount of time. We're talking about something very basic, not necessarily the website being designed and fully developed, but the website being there, being available, like ready for you to take charge.
Right. To open the first Ubuntu launch screen, yeah, that takes 5 minutes.
You know what I mean? So it's a cool thing. It's a cool thing, and Ethereum essentially is making it the same. All that we're really saying right now is that, you know, there's still a level of difficulty. You know, it does require some learning. However, they are making it as user-friendly as possible. So this technology is coming to the people faster than they know, and we're talking about the masses.
Well, so right? Your wallet, you open your Ethereum wallet. Mine is still updating. So tell us more from your experience of after opening the wallet. Like, what did the interface look like? How, like you said, it was user-friendly. So tell us a little bit more about it.
Well, with regards to user-friendly, and I'm going to continue to compare it to the 21 Bitcoin computer. So first and foremost, Ethereum is really trying to separate itself from Bitcoin. It is a separate, you know, blockchain, so it is separate, at least along those lines. However, it's the same concept. It's the same technology. It's the blockchain. But they're, you know, they're wearing the crown of contracts, decentralized contracts. So what they're saying is that, you know, we are going to assist you in the process of coding these contracts, which are going to become self-executed. Right? That's essentially what you're doing. You're sending out an agent. You're sending out an automation, a bot of sorts, right? You're sending out something that is going to be automated on its own and kind of be able to conduct itself. It doesn't require, right? It's just an automation. So what we're talking about right now is that once you comprehend that, right, and all of these are doing that, you go to the the 21 Bitcoin computer. And what you'll find is a repository of this code to have, again, self-executing contracts, a software, what's the best word would you use to describe, you know, these things? Is it, would you use algorithm? Would you say it's just a set of instructions?
Well, it's an application. That's the best way to put it, right? So
yes,
you open it up and you're able to click on stuff as opposed to having to run code. You get what I mean? Because your average person doesn't want to look at code and doesn't understand. They see all those zeros and ones, and then they see all that stuff that, you know, broken English and grammar and hyphens and backslashes everywhere, and they just like, okay, I don't know what's going on here. What do I click on?
So what they've done, so just to speak to that, I want you to continue. What they've done is actually made that very coding, that sort of language, because like you said, we've already prescribed that our folks, you know, study computer science and coding. But they actually provide a copy-paste there for you. They actually have screenshots of what it will look like inside the command line when you copy and paste it correctly. Is that clear?
Yeah, because you can imagine someone not
explanation.
Because if you don't highlight the right amount of code, and you know you miss a part and you input it, and you're like, why isn't it working? Well, you didn't highlight
exactly.
The whole piece of code that it asked you to copy.
It's something basic, right? User error. Right. So what they have is not only the code broken, they not only have the code there for copy-paste purposes, but they also have an explanation of each portion of the code, letting you know what portion of the code is doing what, meaning this portion of the code is for this instruction, right? So what I'm essentially saying is that you go inside of the wallet, and, you know, to even access the wallet, you got to have some ethers, which is the fuel for these contracts as they're describing them on their platform. If you go there, they will call them contracts. They will call them applications. It's almost interchangeable. However, what you end up going into is you find out that, boom, like they have it laid out right there, how to A, have a decentralized organization, let me put it in the proper order. Have your own cryptocurrency code, and you can see the set of instructions in which that currency will behave. Again, it is self-executing like Bitcoin. Remember, there isn't a middleman issuing out the currency, right? So the nature of the coin, you know, you can put in the code and you can actually decide not to put in certain code, et cetera, and put in your own code if you'd like. Right? But they have a very basic prototype there for you to just copy and paste in, as I was describing before. Next up, how to establish a crowdfund for that cryptocurrency. That's the second application that they have right there, right? Everything copy-paste. Third, they have established a decentralized autonomous organization, right? That's powerful within itself. Those are the first three that they readily have available in their repository there on Ethereum as soon as you open up the wallet, as opposed to the 21 Bitcoin computer. Now, this is not to, you know, put one over the other. It is to say that those three types of applications are not available, as far as I've seen, in the 21 Bitcoin repository. However, there are a bunch of other applications, for example, a public notary, right? That is a very valuable, concept in society, a public notary, amongst other kinds of applications. Actually, I may be mistaken, but I think that there are more apps or applications or code available for different apps or different contracts, we'll call them decentralized or smart contracts. They have more. There's more of them there. So that's actually my take. That's my take on the two. What do you think about that?
So we got the birth of decentralized nations, so to speak, and they're running on the virtual world. One day they will become physical, probably based upon, you know, their geographical areas and where they originated at, you know what I mean? But they'll still maintain the decentralized order in their protocol. So, you know, this whole process, like you said, of being able to, one, create a coin, two, crowdsource that coin, and then three, create an organization using the contracts. I mean, the sky's the limit here, you know what I mean? And so let's also bring into the conversation what brother Reggie's brought to the table as well, you know what I'm saying, with the Veracesium, you know what I mean? So banking, finance, all of that, that's what he's offering, right, with his platform?
Yeah, no more brokers and no more banks.
Right, so look at all of this we have here, you know what I mean? We have pretty much the solution to every facet of society and an ability to manifest it in a decentralized order, you know what I mean? So,
absolutely.
All I can say is, you know, we're ready for the next show now, man. I think we did a pretty good recap, you know. I think the world is ready to even hear more and see more. You know, they want to see from us the coin. They want to see from us, you know, the crowdfund for the coin. And they want to see the decentralized organization run and, you know, people become members of it. So that's the great work we have in front of us, is to demonstrate.
True indeed, man. I'm with you on that. Like you said, we are on both fronts concerning this issue because, again, we did introduce at the tail end of this show Ethereum, I'm sure to certain listeners, as opposed to Bitcoin. And these are two different blockchains. So, again, they are the same because they are blockchains. They are different because, again, they're the code associated with each is different. So the behavior of the two is different.
And the differences are very subtle. So, you know, it comes down to who has more usability, you know what I mean? And Bitcoin on its face is not as user-friendly. You have to know, you know, Linux, and you have to know Python, and you have to know Java. So, you know, that you know, bars a lot of people from going deeper into Bitcoin, like how we've gone so deep into it, you know, because we understand coding and we understand the use for the technology. But what Ethereum has done is been able to make this so that the common person can use this. So, like I said, we're having an explosion of these different virtual nations popping up, these different virtual economies and coins. So,
that's right. And you know what? As a means of encouragement, like, you know, and this is real talk right now. You could engage, you know, the two platforms in various manners. Now, like you said, Frey, the biggest barrier is education. The biggest barrier is education. And, you know, we're talking about being able to code, right? We're talking about, you know, the knowledge of these concepts. And beyond that, you know, there's a small financial one as well. So let's say you wanted to engage in Bitcoin and you wanted to deal with the 21 Bitcoin computer. The barrier is $400. Plus, you know, basic coding. You're going to be working from the command line. So you're going to have to, even if it is readily available for copy-paste, and we're talking about the various applications, that'll be as far as you get until someone else shares with you some code they created or a group of other people created. Right, and you don't want to necessarily be waiting on anyone. You want to be able to go for your own, right, go for yourself. So the deal is it's $400 if you want to go the Bitcoin computer route. Obviously, if you already have a computer and you understand coding, then you can actually do something from there. But what they're trying to do, obviously, is make this user-friendly. So what they've done is created a Bitcoin computer. All right, $400 for that. On the flip side, you have Ethereum. Again, as long as you have a computer already, the barrier to entry is about $15. To open a Ethereum wallet so that you can begin to build these decentralized apps, you need at least one Ether. One Ether right now is selling for about $13. So as long as you already have Bitcoin or $13 worth of Bitcoin, you know, they made it so user-friendly. They're using, what is that called, Shapeshift. The exchange, right? So you open up the wallet, you may not have any ethers, but as long as you got Bitcoin, they'll let you shoot it into, you know, Shapeshift to bring out the ethers for you, and then boom, now you're able to start building. See, in Ethereum, you need Bitcoin to create apps, the same as with the 21 Bitcoin computer. You're going to need a certain amount of Bitcoin to create these apps because that Bitcoin will be destroyed, in fact, right? It's like Namecoin. You feel me, Free?
Well, yeah, I wouldn't say destroy because energy cannot be destroyed. You know what I mean? It's re-transformed into a contract.
Yeah, it transmutes. Yeah, it transmutes. You're right.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. You know, so it morphs, man, into it. You know, it becomes that which you will it to be.
No, that's dope. Like, no, honestly, dope. That's real talk because it's not as if nothing comes out the other end, right? So you're absolutely correct on those lines. However, I just wanted to make that point. So we're talking about the difference of $350+ to engage in either or, right? Bitcoin has its value because the most money is behind it as far as the blockchain. However, Ethereum is on the rise. It is number two.
Right. Well, one more difference, right? So with the 21 Bitcoin computer, you're able to at least mine somewhat. I mean, you're only going to make like, I don't know, $3 a week or something like that, but at least you're generating something. And with Ethereum, you're not mining. So you don't have any initial return on investment other than out of the apps you create. You know what I mean?
Sure, you know, you can create an app I think they have some sort of information on the main page about becoming a miner. So it's not that you can't be a miner, but no, initially you're not a miner.
Right.
With Bitcoin 21 computer, the same thing. You still have to kind of turn it on and actually,
right,
like turn on the miner, but it does come with the miner. So you're absolutely correct. In this case, the 21 Bitcoin computer is constantly mining coin for your apps, while on the Ethereum, you might just want to put in Bitcoin as opposed to, and just having ethers in that manner, you know, basically buying the ethers as opposed to mining the ethers.
Right. Yeah. We also have, like we said earlier, the Decentralized Minds project coming up, the Equinox Project, Volume 3. So that will be dropping on the Equinox March 21st, the beginning of the Natural New Year. So everyone be looking out for that. Please support it. The artists that are on it, like I said, everything that we're doing is being published to the Bitcoin blockchain ledger to further, you know, ensure that their rights are protected with their music. So, I mean, it's interesting times, man. Follow the project. Support, support, support. What else you got, bro?
I don't got nothing else, man. I want to tell the family, you know, find us on Facebook, NBA, M as in Moab, B as in Bitcoin, A as in Association, NBA Circle of Peers. Find us on YouTube, Moab Bit, M-O-A-B space B-I-T. I want to say peace and love. I hope everyone enjoyed.
Peace and love.